So, first of all, we have the world premiere. Fanfare, please. Thank you. Artemis is going to introduce our film, the world premiere. We should have had a red carpet, Artemis. Apologies. And then Mark is going to come and talk to us. Mark founded CSIE. So we'll go through the film first, and then we'll do introductions to the next stage.
Thank you. Oh, this is better than this morning. Okay. So apologies to anybody who suffered through poor quality sound this morning. Thank you for bearing with us. So at this point, not that I want to prolong the suspense any longer, but I want to say a little bit about what we've been doing and how this came about. So we're fortunate enough to get the grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund. We've been delving into all the material that CSIE has created and produced and kept maintained throughout all of these years. We've found some remarkable artifacts. Some are around. I mean, I love looking at all of the translations of the Index for Inclusion. You know, we know that there are 40 of them, but just to see them all together. I don't know if any of you have had a chance to see, but I've also put up here, there should also be a red note saying, for display only, please do not remove. But these are all of the various reports from the trends research that Bram mentioned earlier, you know, looking at local authority school placement trends, starting from the 1980s and right up to almost now. So they're there for you to see. And it just unearthed so many interesting, you know, I think the first ever commitment to inclusion of, it was a memorandum or a value statement, I can't remember, from Newham. Just a one page commitment to inclusion, boom, that's all you need to say. We do it from now on. So we've been compiling, on the one hand, a story of CSIE and, you know, how CSIE's role has evolved over the years, and also looking at the context in which this happens. So the story of inclusive school development in the country in these last 40 years. And part of our outputs, if you like, of this project is what you are about to see. And we've tried, in as succinct a way as possible, we have tried to reflect what CSIE stands for and what its contribution has been in the development of inclusive education in the context of national developments. Should I say any more? I don't think I will. I'll just let you hopefully enjoy the film on its own, and then we'll hear from Mark. I will say a few words and then we can have a conversation with him, question and answer session at the end. So here comes the film. Thank you.
Come with me, and I'll tell you a story in education. The early 1980s brought the start of integration. The thinking was that schools should change, and from old ways untether. For all needs there'd be support, so all could learn together.
In the late 1970s, there'd been this huge report into where shall we place disabled kids. And for the first time in history, it came up with a recommendation that led to a law. And it said disabled children should be in mainstream schools provided certain conditions were met. Honestly, most people didn't want that. The professionals didn't want it, the politicians didn't want it. We got hold of the law and promoted it and summarised it and helped parents understand it and helped professionals understand it.
So CSIE was set up as a lobbying and campaigning organisation, and it was established in 1982 with a specific focus to improve inclusive education for all children and young people, and especially for those who have labels of SEND, Special Educational Needs and Disabilities.
High moments of CSIE's work was the publication of the Index for Inclusion. It went into 40 translations.
The index was a tool which had three dimensions, which was the school itself, the community it was in, and what we were actually doing in the classroom. So it was like holding a mirror up to your face and seeing what of these things are we good at and what are we not good at.
From the mid-90s came a change of word quite strong. Inclusion in a local school to show where we belong.
CSA has always been represented on the steering group of the Special Educational Consortium.
The Special Educational Consortium is a group of organisations. We're looking to changes in the legislation, and all of those changes that we've sought have been influenced by CSIE.
CSIE was actually part of the ad hoc committee that wrote Article 24, the education article, for the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
Nearly 1,000 disabled people and their allies were there as delegates and really had a big input into what should be in this convention. The argument was won by disabled people arguing it, but CSI supported it and it was useful to have them there doing it.
The word inclusion grew with time from just S-E-N-D, all aspects of diversity, it slowly came to be.
What CSI does has kind of changed over the years. More recently, there's been also an additional focus on hands-on support for developing more inclusive education.
One of the things that I'm most proud about that CSIE has enabled to happen is a brilliant book called Equality Make It Happen. And within that, what we've done is produce a pack which enables people to think about how to think about equality.
It's hard to think of a more important agenda than inclusion within schools. Indeed, being inclusive and getting that right is so important for our children. If we get it right in schools, we'll get it right as a society.
So one of the things that CSA has done for years, since the early 80s, is to take a very strong interest in how each local authority in England responds to the same national laws.
Since the 1981 Education Act, there was a very steady decline in the proportion of children going into special schools. From the middle of 2000, it sort of bottomed out and started to increase.
Around about 2010, a different mantra started coming out of the government, and it was all about parental choice. If I am a parent and my child learns differently to others, and if all of my local schools in turn tell me that we don't really have capacity to look after their needs, and so a separate special school tells me that they can, what kind of choice do I have?
Since then, demand for special schools has grown out of proportion, at an extreme financial cost, and outcomes great distortion.
So after a very long time of feeling that we've been going backwards, it was very refreshing to have civil servants at the Department for Education speaking positively about inclusion. We're doing all we can to make sure that our core values form part of what will become the new education system, that children's, disabled children's rights are acknowledged and upheld.
Thank you very much indeed. That's lovely and well done. It's been a huge amount of work to pull that together. How would you bring together that into such a condensed amount of time? Really, really impressive.
Excellent.
And really lovely, lovely mix of voices and lovely mix of images as well. So thank you so much, Artemy. That's lovely.
Convey all of that to Oliver Fuller, who created
it
in collaboration.
He was lovely with the way he approached everyone. It was really, really fantastic effort. Okay, we're going to turn to Mark next as founder of CSIE. Artemy's going to come back and
come up.
You can choose to sit or stand.
Artemis going to
stand.
Yeah.
We can do that. We do standing, so long as you're happy to stand on Warnock and
with
the salmon.
Warnock and the salamander segment.
Mark is the founder of CSIE back in 1982. Before that, he'd worked at the Advisory Centre for Education, where my guess is that many of the issues would be raised
up to you?
That were then picked up by CSIE. So, Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
You bring your brain to the early development of CSIE and to talking about it for us. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a lot. Well, what a gift to be asked by Artemy last year to come along and give some reflections on on where CSIE, how CSIE emerged those 40 years ago in 1982.
Mark.
Yes.
Microphone, please.
Oh, yes. Sorry. I was talking. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Mark.
Technology. And if I speak like this, can you hear me at the back? Is that okay? Great. I think a little bit of context, then, if I'm being asked to look back. The late 1970s and the early 1980s were a seminal period in the long history of special education in the UK. There was definitely something in the air. The Warnock report, the Warnock Committee's report recommendations led to the 1981 Act, that came up earlier. So for the first time, a new legal duty on the education authorities around the land. You've got a new duty to integrate disabled kids, and it suddenly had wide-ranging implications for all of our schools. The new law said that old-fashioned Victorian-based offensive labelling, such as maladjusted, educationally subnormal — I think there were two grades of educationally subnormal — were to be replaced with one phrase: special educational needs. All of this was a seismic shift in education policy and practice. It wasn't popular with many people — professionals, politicians, education officers, and others. There's a very important another aspect for the Warnock Report's recommendations, which is they said parents of disabled children were to be far more involved and contribute their knowledge of their children to the assessment and placement of the process of getting that child into school.
You have to wait for the windows.
Take a pause.
Mary Warnock later made a personal public retraction of this idea of greater parental involvement, which she and her colleagues had put into the report. I felt, and many others felt, that she betrayed parents in that retraction. It was very influential. It was a story that went across the national airwaves, that she'd got it wrong, or they had got it wrong. Mary Warnock was influential, but she was wrong, in my view. The law continued to call for that parental involvement. Well, that's setting the scene. It seemed to me like a good idea to set up a new national organisation to promote integration, or inclusive education, as it soon became known. Not least because the legal duty to include disabled kids with differences, was weak, and it contained provisos. And those provisos could easily hold back the development of integration. So CSIE was born in 1982. There was a board of trustees, and in 1987, just a few years in, Belinda Shaw joined me as co-director. More on her later on. The centre very quickly placed its work on a human rights and social justice platform. We drew up a simple 10-point inclusion charter to embrace human rights and social justice. And it was adopted, that charter was adopted by vast numbers of organisations and authorities around the world. I remember the day when Bristol City Council reprinted it as if it was their own. And Belinda and I said, great. We didn't say anything back to Bristol City Council, so it was we hit the right note. But you have to remember, as I'm implying, most people did not want to see the education of kids with differences in this way. So this is my big question. Why was that? It's been flagged up already this morning. Why did most people not want to see the education of disabled kids in that way? There's a deeper history of how so-called able-bodied world had treated those with differences. A deep, deep history towards young people, old people, and CSIE decided to investigate that history. We weren't the only people doing that, but we had to understand society's attitudes by investigating that history. Briefly, what comes to mind is the punitive and racist work of Victorian Francis Galton, who was the pioneer of eugenics. That's a topic that you've already come up with this morning. And it's a method of improving the human race. And the first ever educational psychologist, Cyril Burt, was another dominant figure when looking at some of the building blocks of discriminatory attitudes towards children and adults with differences. CSIE quickly discovered in its early years that there were strong investments in a 100-year-old separate segregated system. And they're heartfelt investments, they're buildings, their hearts and minds, and they are careers, and they are ways of thinking. All of these are deep, deep investments. And they're real. They were real and they were human investments. But for me, there was a legacy of a highly questionable system of identification, assessment and placement of disabled kids away from the mainstream. What's come up this morning already is that system was rooted in the medical model of disability. I was on a new learning curve there, listening to people, adults with disabilities, who drew up the social model of disability. Hearing about the medical model and the social model. From the beginning of CSIE's work, there were many visits to other countries. I remember on a trip to Moscow to talk about inclusive education to teachers, I was introduced to a professor of defectology at Moscow University. It said it on his card, Russian on one side, English on the other side. Professor of defectology. That professor was proud of his title. The thinking and the debate in Russia at that time was a good 30 years behind us. So they wanted, a lot of people in Russia wanted the story. CSIE did not sit on the fence in the discussion about inclusion versus segregation. We said that the long-term goal, with the law behind us, it's a weak law, we know, but with the law behind us, the long-term goal had to be the end of all separate segregated education. That goal included, for us, a remodeled mainstream that provided inclusive schooling for all with appropriate support. By the early 1990s, the core view of staff and trustees at CSIE was that inclusive education should also become embedded as a children's rights issue. Heavyweight research to show that inclusive education was possible for all and that it had good outcomes for all started to appear in the UK and in North America, and CSIE made very good use of those reports and that work. We were impressed that the visionary local law on inclusive education in the US state of Massachusetts had strongly influenced the later national legislation from Washington. So we had to go to Massachusetts and dig around and talk to teachers and parents and families. We wrote a booklet on these changes to tell that upbeat story, and in that project we collaborated with the UK's Campaign for Mental Handicap and published our report here and in Boston. CSIE was strong in promoting the arguments for a shift in school culture, policy and practice, a phrase you already heard this morning, more on that later. I recall a North London educational psychologist in charge of assessment and placement of a young girl that I was involved with in terms of the family. He was saying to me in the late 1990s, so the assessment is complete. Where would we place this girl if she did not have the differences we have now identified? Where would we place this girl if she did not have the differences we have now identified? What would be the normal route? Over the years at CSIE, we collaborated with those at grassroots who were doing pioneering work. The centre really wanted to inform this controversial new debate. We produced about 40 different publications. Artemy has made reference to these. And there's on a range of issues to do with inclusion. There were easy reads. There were good long stories with illustrations. And there were detailed researched analysis of local authority behaviour. We found that there were very many good examples of inclusive school change and which CSI had witnessed over the years. And it was terribly important to collaborate with those instigators of these positive moves and to put them onto public platforms and to get them to write about it. And to get them to talk about it. In short, we worked with those with whom we could work. We were a very small organisation, and that's just a pragmatic and rational approach. We had to work with whom we could work. Someone once said to me and to Belinda that CSIE always seemed to come up with the next best idea to feed into the growing discussions about inclusive school development. But they weren't always CSIE's ideas. We were the messengers a lot of the time, and that was our task. We went around the country and we went overseas to find the different good practice. And yes, sometimes the messenger gets shot. Giving a keynote presentation to the annual meeting of the Association of Educational Psychologists in the early 1990s was not a comfortable experience. We put on over 30-day conferences across England and Wales. 10 of these conferences we collaborated with the Children's Legal Centre. We particularly encouraged delegates to use the weak law to make strong changes towards inclusive practices. We offered advocacy and advice to parents and schools. We gave away masses of free information. And we lobbied at local and central government for improvements in law and policy. We commissioned colleagues at the Open University, Will Swan, and later Exeter University, Brougham Norwich, to research government data on local authority school placements. The massive information there, sitting at government level, nobody else was doing this work of analysing trends across the country. We had a strong relationship with press and media to get the stories across. We organised 2 national inclusion weeks, during which hundreds and hundreds of schools and professionals, parents, pupils, academics and others across the UK promoted their work and their efforts with inclusion. Let me give you a particularly positive story for CSIE. It was the London Borough of Newham, which you've heard about, and Linda is here and mentioned it this morning. Well, it caught our attention early on because here was an education authority in East London determined to reduce segregation and support inclusive school development at all levels. We asked Linda and Chris Goody from Newham to write a report for us. Inclusion was working in Newham, and as you've heard earlier, exam results were improving. Well, that got the doubters interested, even if the extraordinary beneficial social changes did not. Newham was a very good place to bring willing visitors wanting to see good practice at first hand. I remember bringing 53 Norwegian head teachers over to see Newham schools for 2 days intensive study, and they came away extremely impressed. The inspiring work of Newham prompted many of us to say, if it can happen in this town, then why not in another? Further afield, in places such as Cheshire, Oxfordshire, we are very interested in a new development of some special school head teachers determined to gradually move all of their pupils across to the mainstream with training and support over a period of years, to close their schools and actually to end their jobs as head teachers. We took CSIE's work across Scandinavia, Europe, India, Hong Kong, North America, Australia, New Zealand, giving talks and running workshops. For 6 years running, I went for a week at a time to Kristiansand in Norway and then to Prague in Czech Republic to deliver day conferences and workshops. Save the Children Fund, Save the Children UK, got us to do several day conferences and meetings in Bulgaria and Serbia. They had put major resources into their impressive new work in those countries. So you can see how the debate is moving across lots of education providers' minds. So Artemy asked me to mention the Index for Inclusion. It's a key publication. It has a history. I'm not going through all of it, but it's a large and complex set of materials, and it helps schools develop school change. The key lead authors were Tony Booth and Mel Ainscoe, and it went into over 40 countries around the world. We let those overseas publishers have the whole book for nothing. I have since thought, wow, there's some royalty deals that have gone away in the wind with that one, but that's another story.
They're coming back in. I'm really worried that they might trip on this wire, so I'm just going to move it forward.
The index contained the phrase by Tony Booth I used just now, culture, policy and practice. One of the best calls to arms I ever heard if you really want to gradually change a segregationist system of schooling. Examine the school culture, rewrite your school policies, reorganize the actual classroom practices. It's a massive operation if you take on the index. We knew that, but there were lots and lots of schools that wanted to work with it. Tony Blair's government had funded the 3-year index trials, which CSIE had established with colleagues. Later, that same government placed thousands of copies of the finished index materials in every school and local authority in England and Wales. My co-director at CSIE, Belinda Shaw, did groundbreaking research and writing for us about the emerging Canadian experience, which you flagged up earlier, Artemy. Excellent examples to put in front of local UK schools. Groundbreaking stuff at that time. She later went on to do extensive work at the United Nations, for several years running to help get CSIE's perspective into the 2006 UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, particularly Article 24. As you heard from Richard Reeser in this film, Belinda was among hundreds of people from around the world who lobbied the UN to ensure the Convention's ultimate support for inclusive education for all. Given that the current situation regarding disabled kids, the Convention's commitment could so easily have slipped away. There were moments during that hard work by hundreds of people from around the world. There were moments where you thought, it's not going to go through. They're not going to pass Article 24 in this way. But it was pulled back. I think it's remarkable that the UN has backed inclusion in education. It's there for years, okay? UN conventions don't come every other year. This won't be looked at for some time to come, this topic. I said earlier there was something in the air. That's probably why the UN did eventually back it. Richard Reeser, director of the World of Inclusion, once described this whole period I've been talking about as a generous window of opportunity in which to try and influence the education system, to look back over history. Why do we still have this sleeping or overt attitude towards difference? And core to our work at CSIE was the collaboration with parallel work being done by adults with disabilities and difference. At CSIE, Belinda and I realised early on the importance of forging alliances with those who had been the consumers of separate special schooling and who now had a lot to say about the education of future younger generations. I learned from the late Micheline Mason, who set up the Alliance for Inclusive Education, the deep importance of being an ally with disabled adults and children and their parents if the centre's work was going to stay on track. The centre adopted and used the social model of disability in its work, and the centre learned much from Micheline, Richard and other colleagues. We were not always successful in achieving our goals. In the late 1980s, we supported three families who took their quest for inclusive schooling for their disabled children all the way to the European Court in Strasbourg. These local families had simply wanted supported education in their local schools in Herefordshire and in Rugby. They had been rejected at appeal level in those two local education authorities, and then lost appeals to the UK government in London. The Herefordshire chief educational psychologist told the local appeal panel, that was a raw experience, being on the wrong side of the table for myself, alongside the family, and then the professionals are lined up here and the appeal panel is here. He told the appeal panel that the IQ of the teenage girl, Kirsty, with Down syndrome, for whom I was advocate, was off the scale. He said her IQ couldn't be measured by the system he used. That's why she had to go to a special school in Hereford. Off the scale, to describe a lively, enthusiastic learner, who actually went on to further education college early, and thrived. To describe a lively, enthusiastic learner with the phrase off the scale was really one of the most offensive phrases I heard in those early years. We helped the families appeal to the Department for Education, but we lost those cases. It was time to take these appeals to a higher level, the European Court in Strasbourg. We funded the legal fees, we prepared lots of paperwork. We developed strong cases of ordinary school settings within our families' local communities. We demonstrated how it all could work. We supplied a lot of positive evidence and gave it to our lawyers, who put forward a really good case for those three families. We lost all three appeals at the European Court, which simply said there's nothing wrong with the separate school, special school place that has been offered to these families. There's nothing wrong. We've looked at the legislation. There is nothing wrong. Your local authorities have done the right thing. They have behaved well. They have gone by the law. The court totally failed to endorse any of the wider educational and social case that our lawyers had put forward. I tell these stories because that was a lot of the culture and practice at the time. It wasn't the total picture. And the centre was determined to carry on seeking out as much good practice as possible. In conclusion, over the years, I've realised that there's only a small percentage of people in any country, in any education system, who really get inclusion, who really want to make it work, and who understand why it's so important for any civilised society. It's difficult to get down to the soul of inclusion, but it's there, and when inclusion works well, it's utterly inspiring, and it's the right way to go. The pragmatist in me, and I think in Belinda, was that CSIE had to focus on working with that small percentage and hopefully let some of the world be convinced by what the centre did to help reduce segregation and support inclusive school development. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going to take a little extra thing here because I've been invited here by Artemy. I just want to add a very warm personal thanks to Artemy for keeping CSIE going, keeping the ship sailing. That is no mean feat, really. I know how difficult it is, of course, and you've taken it over new and productive waters in increasingly difficult times. Artemy, you will realise, has developed many new projects relating to inclusion, and she's maintained a commitment to the human rights agenda. Well, that is brilliant. Long may CSIE continue. Thank you, Artemy.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark. And as if appropriately, Artemy is going to pick up where Mark left off. And Mark, thank you, if you don't mind staying up here until Artemy's spoken.
Yes, please.
Yes, please. Yes, please. Yeah. And then you can take questions together at the end. Is that all right, Artemy?
Of course.
So Artemy has already addressed you, but she's the current director of CSIE. And really, I think Mark's introduction to her stands in a very good position to hand over directly to you, Artemy, I think, if that's all right. Okay, now, you all right with that? And please, where you have a softer voice than many of our speakers, Artemy, but I just want to check with everyone that they can hear you all right when you speak.
Okay, I think you can hear me now, but if
nods all around the room, Artemy. No, that's
voice,
great.
My voice.
I'll watch out for down. Anyone waving at me. Thank you.
All right. So, thank you, Mark, for such a wonderful introduction to CSIE and explaining, thank you, where it came from and what it did and all of its highlights. And thank you so much for your very last note. If only you knew how I was intending to begin my presentation, you would have known exactly how it dovetails with where we're going next.
Okay.
Because I was, it says so here, if you want proof, that I took over the running of CSIE in 2007, and I did feel that as a huge responsibility on my shoulders. And I really wanted to do the centre justice. You know, it was started as a lobbying and campaigning organisation and has done so many wonderful things before I joined. And I felt a huge sense of responsibility to just keep up the good work, as it were. And over the years, CSIE's work has evolved, as I imagine you would expect, that nothing stays the same. And I have often asked myself, you know, have I done this organisation justice? There are a number of things that have been happening that have made room for new things to happen, but inevitably, if you do new things, some of the old things don't happen. And we have found ourselves doing a lot more hands-on work to actually support the development of more inclusive schooling. And not so much of the really powerful lobbying and campaigning work that CSIE was set up to do. And I begin with the question, and I will return to the question at the end. But I, as I reflect on the nearly 18 years now that I've been with CSIE, I'm thinking there's a lot more. I mean, Mark spoke beautifully about the international elements of CSIE's work in the first 25 years. And in the past 18 years, we've done a lot more project work. We've been invited to collaborate with other organisations. And indeed, you had the Clues project. And we've worked on projects that focus on the quality and the kind of assistance that is offered to disabled children in ordinary schools. We've called those the IMAS project, Improving Assistance in Ordinary School, IMAS 1 and IMAS 2. We've been very involved with the Zero project. The Zero project for a world with zero barriers has awarded CSIE Innovative Practice Award in 2016 for our Equality Toolkit. So the banner back there, Equality Making It Happen. Very, very proud moment. And from time to time, and I don't know how these things happen, but I guess people know about CSIE around the world, and we were contacted about 10 years ago, in 2013, we hosted a study visit, a two-week study visit by an Indian delegation, and we looked after them. I was telling my colleague the story of how I drove a 17-seater minibus for the first time, pretending I've always done this in my life. And we went to London, we went to Norfolk, we went to Bristol, we saw schools, we went to conferences. We did, had a very rich programme activities. We've worked with delegation from Kosovo. People have wanted to come to the UK and speak to CSIE, find out, work with us to figure out what they were going to do to develop more inclusive provision. Incidentally, in one of the displays at the far end booth is a beautiful tapestry, a beautiful piece of material that was gifted to CSIE by the Bangladeshi government, who sent a delegation here to explore the development of inclusion. Worked with Indonesia, all sorts of places. And then we've created new resources. Not as many as I would have liked in the 18 years that I've been at CSIE, but probably as much as we could conceivably do with the resources that we had available to us. And the one that I do feel most proud about is Equality Making It Happen. We worked with schools in Bristol and in London. We, before beginning the work on that, it was the beginning of the early 2010s, 11, 12, when the Equality Act was new, and we were delivering workshops for teachers. You know, the thing that Robin Richardson in his video said was missing. People didn't know about this. We were going out and we were telling teachers what the new law said and what was required of schools. And very little seemed to be changing. Very few people booked. The people who came were saying, everybody needs to come on this. But people didn't come. So we had focus groups, we convened focus groups from practitioners, from educators, and asked, what more can CSIE do to support this work? And they said to create a new resource, and they didn't want an online resource, they said a resource that you can have to hold, to have in your school. And that's how Equality Making It Happen came into being, and that's why it has the kind of user-friendly feel that it has where it happened. There's just reference cards that you pull out, and it's a wonderful starting point. Whatever your issue is at school, you can look it up. You can find out where to get more support. You can get some ideas of how to respond to it. So that is one of the things I'm most proud about. And I have to mention this. There is a photograph on the board outside. In 2019, CSA was invited to attend a reception at Windsor Castle. The NCVO, the National Council of Voluntary Organisations, was celebrating 100 years, and the Queen, being patron of the NCVO, hosted a reception at Windsor Castle. And CSA was, in fact, I was personally invited to attend, and I was told that this is not transferable. And the way my mind works, I thought they must have drawn names out of a hat. Out of 14,000 organisations, 200 were invited. And it was only when I got there and I spoke to the organisers about, you know, how did they select the charities? They couldn't tell me why CSA was selected, but they said that they did very carefully handpick every charity that was invited. And of course, they had to have a balance about larger and smaller and local and national and all sorts of things. So I don't know how CSA was selected. I'm very, very proud that it was. And one of my proudest moments in my 18 years here is very close to the moment that's captured in a photograph, shaking Her Majesty's hand and hearing from her, "Thank you for what you do." She probably had no idea what I do, but I like it that she thanked me.
They're always very well briefed, Artemis, so can't get away with that. They're very well briefed.
Maybe. You will see in the picture, if you look at it, that both of us are in deep laughter because the poor gentleman that had to pronounce my name didn't know what hit him when he saw Artemis Sakellariadis on the card. So you just couldn't say it, and so I couldn't. Some of the other things that I have felt proud of through the development of the work for equality, making it happen, we developed what we now call disability awareness workshops for pupils. So we go into schools and we share with them examples of disabled people who've made a difference, of how disabled people do things differently, of how we're all the same inside, and sometimes, you know, people have different unusual bodies or unusual minds. And children get it. And I know that it's, you know, having those kinds of conversations from quite early on, that we encourage children to embrace diversity and understand that, you know, we're not othering. And it helps build relationships within their schools, you know, for those who have included children with labels of special educational need or disability. And from there, we have extended that. So this morning we talked a little bit about intersectionality, and CSA, and I like Sue's phrase, that we work on equality through the lens of disability. We're not only interested in the well-being of disabled children, we're interested in the well-being of everybody. And when I end up doing things like staying up late at night to develop CSA's response to the consultation on gender questioning children, it's not because CSAE is cut up in all sorts of different ways and tries to do all sorts of different things, but because it's a recognition that there are gender questioning children who are disabled. So CSAE's response talks about neurodiversity and gender identity, and invites the government to look at that and include that in its form guidance. So I digress. I wanted to say that from the disability awareness workshops, we've taken that wider and now deliver workshops that we call equality workshops for pupils, and we speak about all the equality strands. And I think after having listened to Robin's presentation, I will more proudly talk about them as equality strands rather than protected characteristics. And we've got young people to understand about prejudice and about power and privilege, and how, where we are placed, each individual, how the different sections of our identity, that's what intersectionality is, make up who we are, and how if you like on the thin end of the wedge on a number of different equality strands, then you are far more likely to be at risk of being discriminated or treated badly. then if you somehow have identity strands, we call that, yeah, strands that are closer to where the power and the privilege is in our society. I don't want to say very much, well, I do want to say much more, but I won't, because I want to open the floor and have a chance for comments and questions. But I do want to come back to my opening question. I will say one more thing, if I may. Our next big thing that I'm really looking forward to starting, we've done a lot of the planning, and we're about to launch a new project, and we're about to work with parents in Bristol, offering workshops in various areas of Bristol for groups of parents, parents of disabled children. 10 years ago, when we published the local authority trends, the latest report at the time, we went around the country with Parents for Inclusion, as the organisation was then, and we delivered workshops for parents. And at that point, we were telling parents what their children's rights are, what the law says, and what they can do to get what they want for their children. In talking to parents more recently, we realised that there is no need for that. The information is widely available online. People don't need to hear this. But what is more needed is giving people permission and giving them strategies for looking after themselves so that they can be in a better place to look after the children and advocate for them. So that's the project we're about to launch, and I'm very excited about this. And I want to close with a question that I posed myself at the beginning when I thought, have I done this organisation justice? And at times I have thought that what I was trying to do hasn't happened, and happenstance or events have opportunities have taken CSIE in different directions. And there was a time when I would very easily see that as a failure on my part. But I think by now I can celebrate the achievements that perhaps happenstance brought, and that actually, you know, we still are a small team. As Mark said, CSIE has always been very slow on manpower or woman power or person power. But I think that even though we are ending up somewhere where I hadn't initially expected, if I may say so myself, I think that's worth celebrating, and that we have achieved quite a lot, certainly when we take into account the context and the, you know, somebody who is in this room has once said, it's amazing how much CSIE has achieved on a shoestring. And that I'm very proud for.
So you should be. Absolutely.
Well done. Well done.
And you, perhaps some of the context is about a climate that's been less well disposed towards the towards inclusion as well.
So, and towards charities.
And towards charities, very good point, yeah. Thank you to you both. Mark, I mean, I was particularly struck by the journalist. Can you hear all right? The journalistic skills you brought to the establishment and development of CSIE, and the way that you were able to communicate those ideas robustly but courteously. I mean, I remember some of your early conversations with the Special Education Consortium, and that's why I've always welcomed the presence of CSIE on a very broad consortium, which includes people who want to, people who run special schools and people who want to abolish all special schools. And when that lot can agree about something, it's a very, very powerful alliance. And we were able to bring changes to the law, bring changes to policy and guidance, because of the strength of that consensus when you secure it. So, and ultimately, I don't think you should underestimate the move towards involving children and young people themselves and parents in this agenda, because given a local voice, they are then able to take that wherever they go. They'll remember how they felt when they've done one of your workshops with you. And that will go with them. And I've seen it very powerfully in a school I've been working with, where the children are persuaded of the benefit of the way that school works. So, and that important is about the next generation as well. Okay, not for me to pontificate at this point, but I don't think we should let you get away with that. So, questions from you guys to Mark and Artemy. Yes, do please go first.
Do I need a mic?
Speak and see what happens.
No, shout out.
I think I do need the mic.
Oh, all right, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm Nicola Martin from London South Bank University, and I lead a research centre called Building Future Communities. We do a lot about inclusive education, and a lot of it is about inclusive education right the way into university. And I know the Children and Families Act was really remiss in the way it talked about transition to FE and apprenticeship, forgot all about university. And I just wonder what this organisation is thinking about helping that transition as well, and whether we can help you in any way around that transition to higher education, where there's an awful lot of support for disabled students. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your question.
Thank you. What a great question. Thank you, Nicola. I can say two things. One is that we are members of IHE UK, Inclusive Higher Education UK, and it is something that we haven't been able to be very actively engaged because of other commitments and of needing to, too many plates to keep spinning. However, a few years ago, 2018, I think, we were really, really engaged and very involved working here in Bristol, researching experiences of disabled students. And we have an online report that's free to download from our website. And it was part of the widening participation agenda of the university. And we said, yes, widening participation, but for whom? And how much is it possible for disabled students to feel that they belong and to be included? So that on the one hand, brought out some quite interesting research findings. And as is the case with many of the reports in recent years, I think it is presented in an unconventional style. It's got cartoons inside, it's got other things to just bring its message more easily alive. So by all means, have a look at that, and by all means get back to me if you wanted to discuss that further. Thank you for a great question.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Thank you. And some other hands went up as well. Yes, do please. We'd like to go next. Thank you. Could you just say who you are as well, please?
So I'm Nikita Singh. I'm from the University of Bristol.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Good.
I walked down the road.
Great.
I have to admit, before I came, I didn't know much about CSIE, but what you do really speaks to what I understand. And I've been listening today, sort of my first introduction to what you guys do. And I thought it's been really interesting that it sort of talked about legislation, policy systems, and parents. But what I see within the education system is that our young people are really expressing their views of how they feel about the current system. You see high rates of exclusion, more emotional-based school refusal, and those sort of indicators that kids are not thriving in some of these environments. So I wondered, is there a way of maybe thinking or learning a little bit more about how that's brought into this work? Thinking that young people are so good at expressing their views when they're given an opportunity to. And it speaks so much to your agenda, because kids are also the most inclusive bunch, right?
Thank you. Another great question. Thank you very much. And thank you for taking the interest to come to our event today. I wish I could remember more details, but I know that there is an event in Bristol next Wednesday evening at the M Shed. And it's about to launch some new materials that have been developed about supporting young people to become self-advocates. And this is from, I may be misquoting it, but the Disabled People's Forum. I think Bristol Disabled People's Forum. So not much in terms of what CSA has done other than amplifying the voice of the young people that have participated in our disability awareness workshops and sharing what they're saying. But that's given me, you know, an incentive to think some more of maybe what more we could be doing. I'll definitely be going to the event next week to see what they're saying. I also belong to the Diverse Educators Regional Forum, and that meets in Bristol once a term. And my mind has gone completely blank, but that was very relevant a minute ago. I'm really
just
sorry.
Just hold on, Archie. Just while you're trying to catch her, can I just contribute a point from my point of view, as I see it? We are not very good in our education system more broadly about listening to young people and encouraging them to contribute to the ethos of the school, the way the school is run, and so forth. There is still a whiff of a Victorian education system that saw children as the empty vessels, I think it was Dickens, wasn't it? Empty vessels waiting to be filled with gallons of imperial facts. And that there is not, we've not really sustained some of the work by Hargreaves and others who really sought to have a much more participative school community. And I think there is, if there is a problem about engaging more systematically across the system with children and young people, then that is particularly noticeable in relation to children and young people with special educational needs and disabilities, because they are not seen as being so closely involved even as their peers. And some of the people who worked just as natural teachers with children and young people have said, okay, how can we improve this for both of us and for all of your classmates? And have worked out the reasonable adjustments that need to be made that actually make it better for child, teacher, everyone. That's part of the culture that would probably need to shift if we were to become more inclusive across the education system. Artemy, have you remembered what you
Thank
were going
you.
To say?
I have. If I may, I will
I
finish
that. Yeah. So.
Thank you very much, Philippa. I'll finish that point and then I'll hand over to Mark, because I know that CSA has done some work before my time working with young people. But what I was going to say is that there was a general admission within the last Diverse Regional Hub meeting that there's an opportunity for work to be done, to work with young people to enable them to become self-advocates, because people are finding a voice and knowing, learning about their rights, but sometimes lack the knowledge of what are effective mediums of putting that forward and arguing and promoting their rights. But Mark, would you like to...
Just if, briefly, yeah.
The tapes, isn't it, that you, that Belinda...
Well, the children's voice, the young person's voice, incredibly important. Early on, we put on one of our day conferences with the Children's Legal Centre and got the UN Commissioner for Children's Rights, whose name I've forgotten. He was a key speaker, but the most powerful part of the day was getting children and young people up on the platform and running their sessions to 200 people in this auditorium in Kensington, I think, in West London. It's incredibly powerful when you let the children and young people talk about how life is different when you give them this different kind of experience. Quite early on, CSIE took about 20, 25 young people, some with differences and some not, on an adventure week down to Cornwall, and we wrote a report about that. It was a very, very positive and, again, a powerful experience for the whole of the group of children. It was a special school in North London, and it was a Quinton Kenniston...
Yeah.
Big secondary school.
The Swiss Cottage, yeah.
And everybody was given a free rein to opt in for this free week down in Cornwall Adventure Camp. Who was going to say no? It was absolutely staggering. It was a seminal moment for lots and lots of us to see how interaction could change. I've got to go back to Newham and also other education authorities, where Belinda and I sat down and talked with families and talked with teachers and got the individual stories of how children and classroom practices were changing quite dramatically. They, as I said before, they were very, very inspiring. And the young voice, which is why it has to be that, why the trustees and the two staff said we've got to embed all of our work in children's rights as well as human rights and social justice. So thank you for bringing up that topic, children's.
Thank you. Thanks for your question, very helpful. Could we hold your question? There will be time for more questions at the end, but I want to make sure we hear from Linda and from Richard, and then perhaps you could just hold your question and see if any of the discussion with Linda and Richard then actually change the question you're going to ask, or just write it down and ask it anyway. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mark and Artemy. It's the reason for the day is what you have achieved between you, and we couldn't be more grateful, and the response of everyone so far to today, I think, assures you of the importance of the work of CSIE. Thank you. Thank you very much. Right, Linda, welcome. You've already spoken, but people have heard your voice. But the reason that Linda is here is because she played a really, really important role in the development of inclusive education in a number of ways in her professional role in education, but probably most notably for her role as an elected member in Newham and instrumental in bringing in the Newham policy, which you've heard about or at many moments
several
in
times.
Today. Everyone has heard about. Linda, just a quick practicality. Do you want to sit or stand for
I think I'll sit because I fell over 3 days ago and I've hurt my back.
Okay. Come sit on this here because that's where the microphone is already. We'll just adjust that for your... Have you still got a teacher voice?
I've got a teacher. Is that working?
Doesn't sound as if it's on. Let's just check if it's on. Just
that's it.
There we go.
I have got a teacher voice, but it's not very good at the moment because I had a very bad cold for 4 weeks over the Christmas and I've damaged my vocal cords because I cough so much. So that's why it sounds a bit raggedy. Thank you. So it's fantastic to be here. I've been part of the CSIE family from almost the beginning. But I just wanted to start, I wasn't going to say this, but I have to mention Mary Warnock because she's been mentioned a lot.
And you're resting on her as well.
Yes, I'm resting on her because I came into the SEND world because when I was at university, I left school at 16 and went back to university when I was 28 or something. And Mary Warnock was one of my tutors and I had her for philosophy of mind. But she had just finished writing the report. And instead of having 8 tutorials on the philosophy of mind, we had 8 therapy sessions because she wanted to talk about the horrendous time she had had doing this inquiry into the education of mentally handicapped children. So I learned a lot about special educational needs right back in 1978. I was very disappointed, and I did work a lot with her in Newham. She came to Newham a lot. And so, was it 2005, she wrote that ridiculous paper.
Yep.
I wrote to her, and I've got her reply, and maybe that should go into... and what she basically said is, what you've done in Newham is wonderful, it's fantastic, it's amazing, but it can't happen everywhere. And it taught me that just because someone has got the label of philosopher, it doesn't mean they're very clear thinking. So my journey with CSIE started in, I think it was early 1983, because my first child, Ellen, was born with Down syndrome in 1982. And We were not unhappy that we'd had a child born with a disability. It didn't matter to us. Both me and Ellen's dad were already campaigners for social justice and equality. We understood that human beings are a diverse group, and we were very happy with our firstborn child. And very quickly, lots of people gave us all sorts of messages that actually society doesn't like disabled people. The paediatrician who told us that children with Down syndrome stop learning when they're seven, etc. You know, I could tell you whole stories about that. Fortunately, we quite quickly got connected to other parents with young children in Newham, where we live, who all were very excited that we had new legislation. So I disagree with Artemy. I think the 1981 Education Act was amazing, because it gave us a hook on which to campaign, because it did say that children should be going to mentoring schools. So there's a big group of families in Newham, children with all sorts of differences, and we came together and we made a pact that our children would all go to mainstream schools and they would have ordinary lives. And it was very empowering. And very soon after that, I think it was early 1983, there was a conference at what was then, it was Bedford College, which was then located in Regent's Park. And CSIE ran a conference with the Children's Legal Centre and a couple of other organisations. And it was a really big moment in my life, because I thought, I kind of knew this was part of something bigger, and I'd landed in this room with quite a lot of people who all felt the same, and it was very, I suppose, life-changing for me. So I want to thank Mark and Artemy for the work that you've done. And quickly it became clear that this was a movement, as Mark said, it was a time, it was the right place, right time, right. There were lots of organisations springing up. So there was Action 81, which was a parent-led organisation. There was a Parents Campaign for Inclusive Education and others. And so there were large numbers of parents across the country, in a relatively large, it wasn't just like 10 of us, there were lots of parents all over the country with the same views. And we were very empowered, because we knew there were lots of us. And we all started campaigning in our local authority areas. We campaigned nationally. We had demonstrations, etc. And what happened to me in my local area in Newham is that in 1986, I stood for election to the local council. By the way, I was a teacher. While this was all happening, I was a secondary school teacher and I worked in special schools. And I got elected to Newham Council and became chair of the education committee. So, and that was mainly because people in Newham wanted me to lead a policy of inclusive education. So, as Artemy said, I wrote half a side of A4, which said it's wrong to segregate children on the basis of disability. We're going to do something about it, and we're going to enable children to go to their local schools. I took it to the Labour group meeting. A few people asked questions like, oh my God, how are you going to do that? And I said, don't worry, we won't do anything stupid. It will all be done properly.
Along with noisy windows.
And it was all based on human rights.
Wait for a sec till it finishes.
It was all based on human rights. So in my role as chair of education committee, I had to obviously work very closely with officers. And quite quickly, those people that didn't agree with the concept left. So the director of education, the principal educational psychologist, the paediatrician, all left. They summoned me and said, are you serious? And I said, yes, and they all resigned. So I was in a very wonderful position to be able to appoint a director of education who lived and breathed inclusion and wanted to have an opportunity to develop it. A principal had said the same, and I don't know what, I can't remember what happened with the paediatrician, but obviously it wasn't somebody obstructive, because we made really good progress with health. And I can't really tell you the story of what we did, because obviously that would take probably an hour. But basically, we co-produced a new system with young people and families and disabled adults. And we did it in all sorts of ways, but the outcome was that we had a community of people who believed in education, and I do believe in inclusive education. I believe that is a critical thing. This is an issue of choice, and it is about what you believe in. And we were flooded with people who wanted to work in Newham. So every head teacher appointment that we made, we had 10 people that we could have appointed, because people wanted to come and work in the borough. Essentially, the components were a really strong learning support service and behaviour support service, very strong school inspection system, a service that had advisory teachers around disability who were able to monitor school practice. The learning support service delivered lots of a very, very robust training. I mean, every head teacher, every teacher and every person who came to work as a support member of staff were inducted very strongly, and there was a very strong training programme. And we started with the early years. Every child from then on, always caveat, parents still had the choice to choose special. Every young child started in their local nursery, and the learning support service supported that nursery, and blah, blah, blah. That service gradually grew over the years as those children moved into primary and then into secondary. And in parallel with that, we closed 7 special schools. And those so when, you know, it's not really I hate this term, abolish special schools. We are not talking about bricks and mortar. Teaching and learning, good pedagogy, caring, kindness, humanity is not about bricks and mortar, it is about people. And most of the staff who worked in the special schools that we closed became people who worked in the mainstream system. They either worked as teachers in schools or learning support assistants in schools, or joined the learning support service. But central were disabled adults, because they provided the history, they reinforced how important this was, they worked with children in schools, etc. But our biggest resource were our children. We co-designed our new system with the children who were in the special schools and children in mainstream schools together. Children made it work. Young 3-year-olds get inclusion. They understand how to support their peers. And, you know, I could give you so many thousands of anecdotes which bring tears to your eyes, but my own daughter's experience, she's got Down syndrome, a learning disability, or she's had about 20 different labels throughout her life, and she's now an adult with a learning disability. She went through nursery, primary, secondary, college. She never had one-to-one support because she didn't need it. Her schools were inclusive. They understood what to do. Teachers were amazing and knew how to differentiate lessons. But most importantly, her peers supported her. You know, they taught her so much about everything, the world, about sex, about everything. And she's now married. She married 2.5 years ago, and her bridesmaids were half. She had 8 bridesmaids. No, sorry, she had 11 bridesmaids, because she had 3 little girls, but they were, half of them were kids that she'd known from primary, secondary and college. So she's got an amazing social life. So Artemis said, don't talk too much about the past, what about the way forward? So basically, I think the country was on a roll. I think we made amazing progress through particularly the 1990s. I think the environment in our education sector was really exciting in the 1990s. We had many opportunities. We were making much more fuss about inequality, whether it was racism, homophobia, sexism, etc. And it was a lovely environment to work in as a teacher for me. Teachers learn so much more. I mean, if you're teaching mixed ability groupings, you become a much better teacher. I mean, the joy of having to teach a mixed ability group and thinking about your lessons, how you're going to make sure that you're really getting the best out of those children that are going to go on and get lots of A stars and everything, as well as the children with profound and multiple learning disabilities, is just such an exciting job to have. I think as a movement, as an inclusive education movement, we should have made more fuss when we started to see things going wrong, which was probably 2008, 2006, when gradually the ideology, I suppose you'd call it, that had permeated education through the 90s and into the 2000s, which was much more egalitarian, it was much more about equality, when exam results went up more dramatically than they have ever. So inclusive schooling is better for everybody. When that change happened, it was clear that it was an ideological move against inclusion because I think, as I said earlier, I think the establishment were getting quite frightened. And it was a very similar debate to we had in the 1870s when the establishment didn't want universal education because they were worried about the working class becoming educated. It was the same kind of fear that we were having too many working class kids who were previously kept down, now going to university, getting more educated, more worldly wise, and I think that was the reason that we saw another turn backwards and we started to have this idea that we want to go back to, you know, more of an academic curriculum. And we've now got to this insane position. I'm sorry, I know insane is a discriminatory word, but I cannot think of another word. Insane situation where our school system is not fit for purpose for any of our children. And I think if we're going to go forward, we all as a movement, everybody that's interested in this stuff, whatever equality lens we're coming from, because the system is very, very bad for working class kids and for kids of different ethnicities. Black kids in London are so overrepresented in the SEMH category, in our alternative provision and so on. So I think we've got to really campaign for an education system that is based on equality, that children are taught to think, not drilled, through learning phonics and lessons that are about getting through a particular PowerPoint, you know, before 3 o'clock, otherwise, you know, you're going to get told off by the head. So we need to completely rethink our education. The government are making some good noises, which is fantastic, so we may have some opportunities. My worry is that we've got forces of darkness that are really scary across the world. So it's more important than ever that we argue for equality for all of our populations, but, you know, thinking about education, our schools need to be about nurturing children. They need to be about teaching children to think, learn together, learn about what works in the world, you know, what humanity is. That's not going to happen, but it's what we should be campaigning for, because we've got to, I think that voice has got to be there. And going back to the question about young people, I work for National Development Team for Inclusion, and all of our work is co-produced. We've delivered the Preparing for Adulthood programme nationally for the last 10 years, and that work was co-produced with 400 young people across the country who told us that they want ordinary lives. They all were in special schools. And so I think we've got to stop making it complicated. I think inclusive education, if I learned nothing else in Newham, it was that it is not complicated. It is not complicated. As chair of the Education Committee, it was the easiest thing I did. Because once you establish the principle, you work it out. I think it's Gordon in New Brunswick always says, you just do it and you work it out. Because the solutions are obvious. You need people who understand and have got the experience of working with all sorts of children, with all sorts of, you know, children that have been othered, children that have got all sorts of challenges. You need them in the system, so that's obvious. And how you do that can be all sorts of different ways, but it's essentially, you know, a learning support service. And schools have got to be made to implement the law. Our law is, with all its weaknesses, is one of the strongest legislations in the world. And it's being broken every day in every local authority by all partners. If schools were made to do what the law says, we wouldn't be where we are. We work a lot with head teachers, and I always ask head teachers how they implement the Equality Act in their school. Usually in a group of 20, one might be able to answer that question. The rest do not know what you're talking about. So I think the new government has got to, as part of its, presumably we will have a strategy at some stage, hopefully not too distant future. We need a strategy that is essentially about implementing the law and being curious about how we do that. There, although people like myself, I'm 75 next week, and a lot of us who, I'm including Mark, yeah, I don't know how old you are, Mark, but you're getting on a bit. Those of us that know how
to... I told him how young he is.
Those of us that know how to do this haven't got long left. You know, those of us that actually had the experience and know how to do it. So I urge anybody that's got any influence to get us at the table. You know, Bridget Phillipson needs people around her who know how to do this because she says she wants schools to be inclusive. Having worked up close and personal with the DfE, including ministers, they have no idea what to do. There's enough of us left who know how to do it because we've done it. We need to be at the table. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
To say something about the time. What we're doing in Newham, so Newham has been affected by the forces of darkness as everywhere has. We're going to have a revival in Newham. We're going to have a big celebration in July to relaunch. It's got a lot of good practice, but we need to relaunch in Newham, and we're going to have a celebration event, and we're going to undig time capsule that CSIE buried in 1992.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much, Linda.
Can I be there?
Yes, of course you're going to speak.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. And we'll ask you back after Richard's recorded presentation. We'll ask you back to come take questions, if that's all right. Thank you very much.
Did you want to take the previous question while we're loading up Richard? Because we are going to run out of time.
Okay, lovely. So one question for Linda. It'll have to be fairly quick.
I was wondering.
It's okay.
Yes.
I want to take, but it's fine. Honestly, it's fine.
Yeah, go on. Whilst we're getting the film up.
I suppose it was a response to what this young lady said and also to what you've said, which is... that the people who can talk most directly to politicians about the difference it's made is the young people who've been through the system.
Yes.
And do you have young people in Newham who go out and talk to people?
We have got many, many young people in Newham, across the country, people we work with at NDTI who are passionate about speaking to anybody and everybody.
Yeah. That's all it was.
There's a small reminder that in a democratic system, we don't always get what we want. Working with the Special Education Consortium, which I mentioned earlier, we worked with some young people who took their requests to the minister at the time, Edward Timpson. They very much wanted the proposed education, health and care plans to continue with them into university. And many of the things they had argued for with the minister did get incorporated. This bit, take a lesson from my own, but yeah, I'll wait, don't worry. But I was the one who had to go back and explain to these younger people afterwards, because we'd taken them through the whole parliamentary process, etc., etc. I had to go back and explain what had got incorporated into the law and what hadn't. And when I said, look, I know you argued very long and hard for this, as did others, that the education healthcare plan should continue into university, we didn't get it. They could not understand it. Mm. We asked for that. Mm. But we didn't get it. Mm. How comes? Mm. You know, you helped us to organise to get it going. Why hadn't it happened?
It's tough.
We had to say, these are the people that the country voted for, and that is what has happened through democracy. So we need to remind young people that they can argue for this. It may not happen, they will need allies to help facilitate, of course, and NDTI is a fantastic example of an organisation that works in that way. Mm-hmm. We don't all necessarily get what we want even when we argue passionately for it. Richard will argue with the best of them and very passionately, so let's hand over to Richard.
Hello, everyone. I'm sorry I can't be with you in person today, but my travel arrangements after the holidays don't allow for it. So therefore, I've recorded my comments and thoughts, and I wish you all a good day's deliberation. This comes at a crucial time with the new Labour government now beginning to think about education and the select committee coming in January for us to put our views in. And so I would urge people all to put forward their views to that. We've had in the autumn the curriculum review, which I think it was very important to put in the issues of both pedagogy for all learners and to have a curriculum and assessment system that is fit for purpose for all learners, and but particularly the experience of learners from various oppressed groups, such as disabled young people, should be in the curriculum, as should racism and sexism and homophobia should be part of the curriculum that everybody learns in this society, which is aiming towards a more equal position for people. Going into why I think the work of CSIE has been very important, started by two journalists, Mark Vaughan and then later Linda, who joined him, to actually take this forward. Mark was actually based at SCOPE, or as it was called then, the Spastic Society, and then eventually set out separately. But he was convinced from a values point of view that inclusive education was the right thing for disabled young people. And that's where CSAE started. And they began by looking at the values that had been produced in various international documents. And then we began to work on the Index for Inclusion in 1996. And I was happy to be part of that. I was then advisory teacher for inclusion in Hackney. There were a number of practitioners on that working group and some academics as well, including Tony Booth and Mel Ensko. And we had a lot of discussions and even fraught discussions. Eventually, it was agreed that a social model approach should be taken, though some of the academics didn't really agree with that. They were still stuck into the old special needs model, but trying to turn it on its head without recognising that disability was an oppression and had to be treated as such. In the end, we won out, and it became important that barriers were looked at. But I have to say that some of the articulations of those weren't very clear, and I think we still need to move forward on that. My thinking had started on this 10 years before, when I had been put together with Micheline Mason by the dying ILEA to produce a handbook to hand on to parents and local authorities, taken over from the amazing ILEA to the 13 fragments that Mrs. Thatcher decided for ideological only reasons to put them together in. Smashing up a lot of good practice for just pure ideological venom that she had. There was no practical reason for it. 97% of parents wanted to keep it. It had the best provision in Europe for an education authority, and perhaps that was why it was a centre away from government. So it's all been political. And in coming together, I was introduced from a SEN and equalities point of view, and general political point of view, to the politics of the disability movement, which had started some 20 to 30 years before with UPIAS in the UK, and then the setting up of Disabled People International in 1981, which made the clear distinction between our impairment, which is our loss of function, and the effect of that on us through social, cultural, environmental, and attitudinal barriers. That remains the main dividing line, as far as I can see. And you have to believe in that value that disabled people are human beings and have equal value to others. And once you agree with that, then you have to agree
with the provision that needs to be put in place so that they can maximise their learning and participation. The old route of segregatedness, which started with eugenics in many ways, although there were prior to that strong arguments from blind and deaf communities for separate special schools because the mainstream at that time could not accommodate the learning of the Braille or sign language that was required in the earlier part of the 19th century. But beyond that, the eugenics movement decided that disabled people were a threat to the gene pool and had to be kept separated from everybody else, and that led to many of our special schools for learning difficulties that grew directly out of this. Nobody was really concerned with the outcomes of the people in these places. They were concerned to keep them away from everybody else in the population. And so it's been part of that breaking down of those barriers that has taken the time. Perhaps in the 1980s, more widely, people began to see there was a need for this, but it was not until the 1990s, really, that we saw the transition of that thinking into education. And that was, first of all, with a book that myself and Micheline Mason, who sadly died earlier this in 2024, put together based on the social model. Let's be clear, impairment is part of the human condition. It's always been with us, it always will be. Children who develop an impairment or are born with an impairment have a right to the same sort of life as everybody else. While placing us in separate schools and seeing us as a deficit, you create barriers which mean that you will never develop inclusion. So it is this funding model, the deficit funding model, and the assessment procedures that go with it, which causes the main issue which prevents inclusion. We need to stand for schools and colleges where all can attend and where the barriers that they face and the particular support that they need is provided. That's more expensive than one which ignores those young people. But of course, when the parents of those young people kick up because the provision isn't there in the mainstream and argue for specialist support, it bankrupts the education system as we are seeing at the moment. So the solution is not more segregation or various gimmicks, but is actually looking at what the key barriers are in our schools and addressing those. The key barriers are the culture of the school, as we identified in the index, how people are treated, and that means challenging all harassment, name-calling, bullying, which is levelled at people because of their physical or mental difference, and creating a more harmonious environment within the school and making that a priority for all staff, parents, community and school students. Secondly, developing the pedagogy that is necessary to be able to run a multitasking class at any one time, so the teacher becomes the conductor of a series of support workers of various sorts who are in the classroom, supporting the young people and sometimes taking them out for small groups and so on to reinforce what's happening. You don't have to be in the classroom all the time for inclusion to work, but you do need to be part of the social group. You need to be there for the majority of time, and you need to flourish there, have a good self-image and be supported by your peers. And that means building support using person-centred planning approaches. It means that the curriculum has to be filtered through those needs so that all can learn at their own pace. And that, again, is more difficult if you're not used to doing it. But, of course, the largest teaching device in the classroom is the other students. And once they are involved in the process of learning and learning with each other, then it becomes much more effective. And we've seen this in many parts of the world where you just stop the chalk and talk from the front and devise by turning the desks round into clumps of desks that the groups work together on the tasks and the children learn from each other. And we know there is evidence that all children, even with significant genetic conditions, improve above the level that was predicted when they are in this learning environment because they learn from their peers. The opposite is true when you segregate them by impairment. They learn at the lowest rate and they don't learn very much. So we know that the psychology of inclusion works. We know that working together will change the attitudes within the whole learning establishment. It will also change the community. And that's why the policies are important, but the policies need to be worked on by everybody. And a whole school approach has been shown to be by far the most effective way of doing this. And then the practices need to be analysing the barriers that are there that prevent the inclusive process. Now, we've moved on since the index. We've had 25 years now of inclusive practice in some places. It's been hit by several major political problems. The first was that although under David Blunkett in 97, the Labour government was for inclusion, 10 years later, by 2007, under Lord Adonis, they denied that they had ever been for it. And the reason for that was the main thrust of Tony Blair's education, education, education was some unidimensional assessment linked to PISA and other international scores that all children could learn at the same rate and in the same way and you could measure it. This is absolute nonsense, but most politicians still seem to think it's the right way. You cannot have 100% of an average score for anybody. People need to be seen as their own development, the way they make progress, measured in many different ways. So we need to see that we need to focus now on doing these things. We need to make sure that we have a flexible curriculum which allows all young people to progress with different routes through it, including a route to a vocational in the higher levels of the from year 9 onwards, if even before, so that you can actually leave with a vocational qualification of equal value to the academic one, that you can progress in terms of skills which we don't measure, which should be assessed on an ordinal scale, such as your ability to motivate others, your ability to make people happy, your ability to make people laugh and participate. Those real life skills which employers value, which we don't measure with our GCSEs and our assessments. We need to find a way of assessing those, perhaps through peer assessment and self-assessment, so that we actually do look at the whole young person. We need to introduce into the curriculum understanding of disability as an oppression and how it's been rooted in all cultures at all times, and now we have to draw a line under it and say, no, we value everybody and we will accept them and we will not accept disablest behaviour, disablest administrations, disablest procedures, and we need to work towards that. We, as a halfway house, I think it's important to have additional resources in mainstream schools. I believe that those resources should be there to support the young people, sometimes by withdrawal, but mainly in the mainstream classroom. They are a pole of expertise, particularly when you're looking at social, emotional, mental health, but also on behaviour, which the last government took out of SEND. We think it's really important that these are put back in and that schools, rather than having a one-dimensional system of three strikes and you're out, recognise the diversity that is necessary and bring back emotional intelligence, which was working really quite well in 2009 and 2010. Really, the austerity measures which the government introduced have decimated SEN provision and inclusion. Let's be clear about it. I did a programme for the government in 2003 looking at good practice on making reasonable adjustments. We went and filmed in 40 schools. I've been around those schools and they all had good practice. They'd self-nominated and we judged them against certain criteria before we visited. And we were interested in looking at the actual practical things, being a fly on the wall, talking to staff, teaching staff, support staff, pupils, management and parents. And we've got a very good picture of that, which you can still see in the programme that's on my website, worldofinclusion.com. And you will be able to see there 5.5 hours of filming in those 40 schools. Now, that was in 2003. Here we are 21 years later, and much of that practice has disappeared. Why? Because of the strictures of central government introducing what they think they know is right for education when they don't. You need to get it back down into schools. We do need the local authorities, so whatever arrangements we have with academies, they need to be back into local authority support. The support systems need to be built up again, because no one school can have the expertise on the adjustments that are needed for every type of impairment. But nevertheless, they can learn. And all teachers need to be mandatorily trained throughout their career, as well as on initial teacher training and support staff, so that they can actually carry out what is necessary according to the UNCRPD, which we fought for so hard in New York and ended up with Article 24, which was not adequate, and CSIE were there fighting alongside the British Disability Movement as an ally. And we then fought for and won the General Comment Number 4, which goes into much more detail and is part of the jurisprudence of the international law on inclusion, and can't just be ignored. It is being ignored by a whole number of countries, and this is one of the big problems that we're having in implementing disability human rights across the world. People are not connecting to this paradigm shift from seeing the problem in the person. The problem is in the system, and our thinking, it is ossified in the system. We have to change it. So last thing, what do we need to do? We need a new curriculum, which is flexible, with different routes through it, which has matching pedagogy that allows everyone to make progress at their own rates. We need peer support. We need ownership of disability, along with other equality areas within the school, so that young people grow up challenging the historic oppressions of the past and learning to live and work with each other. And we need to welcome each and everybody's achievements, and we have to have ways of demonstrating that so that all can manage. We need really to make all our schools accessible, and the government, successive governments, have refused to put an end date on that. Well, it's really not good enough after 22 years since the NHS had to do it that the school system still doesn't have to do it. So we need to have access to all buildings, but also access to the curriculum and new pedagogy, and that means reasserting the role of higher education as a place that actually can develop the pedagogy of inclusion, as well as developing it in the classroom. So there's much to be done to get rid of the 14-year blight which David Cameron brought on through his ridiculous ideas that we've gone too far with inclusion. We've gone nowhere near enough, and we still have far, far way to go. But if you don't believe in it, it will never happen. You have to believe in the human rights. You have to think that people are of equal value. And that's how we need to go forward. I thank you.
Thank you, Richard. And thank you, Linda. Would you like to come and just respond to any questions? I think probably you, maybe I can help. I was involved with Richard on the Reasonable Adjustments Project. We both made some contributions to that. And so between us,
See if there's any questions.
Come here so you can eyeball people and speak directly to them, as it were.
May I suggest that we take five? We've only got 10 minutes left, so maybe 5 minutes for questions and 5 minutes for chairs.
Yes, perfect. That's roughly what I had in mind. Yeah. Yes, we need to finish for people to go and catch trains and etc. So, questions for Linda and for Richard. And Artemy, you might want to come and join us as well, because you've worked closely with Richard too. If you had questions which are either directly or indirectly for Richard, I think probably between us we can probably feel.
I worked with Richard in Hackney. I was his manager. No comment.
You mean when he was in short trousers still? Yes. Okay, colleagues, any questions to Linda, Richard, that we
or
might...
anybody, or just comments?
Yes, thank you.
Something that I've sort of been thinking about is that a big problem is the fact that you've got mainstream school and you've got special school and people are stuck. And I'm wondering whether we need, it's not a right to mainstream school, we just need a right to inclusive education and inclusive schools, not mainstream. I think it's like, it's a bit of, it's part of the problem, I think, in people actually, because at the moment we've got mainstream schools where they're trying to adapt and tweak, and it's not working.
No.
So do we need to actually start saying, no, actually we need something completely different?
Yes,
we do. Different language then, isn't it? Different
types of schools.
That is an interesting question, and it plays into what Bran was saying this morning about... can a special school be inclusive if children in that school feel they belong and indeed get good outcomes? Yeah.
I think from a mainstream point of view more than anything.
Yeah.
I think
with
the difficulties with special schools is you've got no chance of mixing with
anybody else. Yeah.
You're literally, and that to me is the harm. That's the harm. And I, with my son, I'd rather him not learn. It's more important that he belongs and he exists.
I think Linda. That is the crux of the problem. People who oppose inclusion do not understand that people have a right to be part of their community. You have to be present to be part of your community. And I think the example of young people with the label of profound and multiple learning disabilities is really interesting because it's my passion. I was chair of governors of a school in Newham after, you know, many years after we developed inclusion, and we were resourced for children with profound and multiple learning disabilities. And it was an absolute that they would spend at least 80% of their time in mainstream classes. So they were all part of tutor groups, they were in all the mixed ability classes, etc. And it was amazing. The impact on behaviour was phenomenal. It's a school in Canning Town in East London where you would expect there to be massive behaviour problems. It was humane. The impact on children that had other difficulties, needs, challenges was incredible because I think what they thought was, if they care about them, they care about me. There was absolute zero tolerance of bullying or any oppressive behaviour, but it wasn't done in a draconian rules way. It was done in, let's all talk about it. It was talked about at assembly, but, you know, all the time. But there are people today who believe those children should not be in mainstream schools, even in a unit. And the comment is usually, what is the point? And we've had experts in Newham, not in Newham, people who have come into Newham schools, who hate it. And their comment is always, what is the point? So they don't think they are equal human beings. They see them as some other thing over here. The language is appalling. It's that thing of off the scale. If they're off the scale intellectually, and I hate intellectual disability that is used across the rest of the world, I think it's very offensive, and I'm glad that we don't use it. This thing of some people are really intellectual and really clever, some are a bit, you know, this measuring, it's still so embedded in our thinking, despite the fact that we say we don't do IQ tests anymore. So we've got so many, it's beliefs. Once people think everybody has got equal value, should have equal access to resources, but some people need more in order to create equality, that's our fight.
Yes.
And it's got worse rather than better, certainly over the last 5 or 6 years. And the fact that in the legislation, there's a thing about it's okay for a child to be in a mainstream school as long as they're not a burden on the other children, they're not impacting on the learning, is shocking.
Linda, thank you very much. No, thank you.
My rant.
Thank you. No, rant away. This is your opportunity. Other questions? From?
This is for you. I wonder, Artemy, if you considered trying to forge links between CSIE's ideas of inclusive education and UNICEF's tradition of rights respecting schools, which is based on the Convention on the Rights of the Child. I mean, I say that because I think that rights respecting schools is about everyone, and it puts a very strong emphasis on not just learning your own rights, so it's not just egocentric rights, it's respecting the rights of others. And it seems to me that that might be a useful way of dealing with issues of the culture at schools. I must say, this is something I've learned about more recently, and I have done research which does seem to suggest that people who think deeply about inclusive schools, although they don't reflect rights respecting schools principles, actually do come up with thinking that is very in tune with rights respecting schools. So I just want one thing to add.
Thank you, Brian. What a great question. And it's hard for me to put into words what happens in 18 years outside of when you're in the fast lane. I think the answer is nothing. So, yes, it's something that has been considered a number of times. We've had 2, maybe 3 attempts at making a connection. But some of it is, I guess, happenstance of who picks up a message, who makes who brokers a connection, and whether it takes root or not. And it pains me to say that it hasn't taken root yet. If you do have any contacts and you would be willing to introduce us to, you know, it'd be great. I would love to be more connected with rights respecting schools.
I have no links to the rights respecting schools, but I have research which does show very strong links.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mentioned the work that we did in a school about. Okay. Thank you. I'd love to talk to you afterwards. The school that we worked with in Slough about equality workshops for the pupils, they were also signed up and they were very excited about working with rights respecting schools. Again, that was an opportunity missed to connect. But one day, I'm sure the stars will align, and it might be that today they're beginning to align. And thank you if you do.
Mark, can I just take... You wanted to come in on this particular issue, you?
I'll be very brief because I know that I've got a hand up here, but it's maybe a question to yourself, Philippa, and also to Bram. It's about, is there any chance of rekindling a research project that happened probably about 30 years ago where somebody said there is a peer group, able-bodied peer group, we're helping disabled kids in ordinary schools. Let's analyse what's happening to the disabled kids and how they're moving on. And it came out that the disabled kids were coming out with improved indicators on lots of different levels. And then somebody said, what about their mentors? Let's do a study on that. Mm-hmm. And statistically speaking, the mentors were way up here in terms of the results coming back. We use that at CSIE from time to time. It's going to be another one to just have another bit of armoury.
The Alana Institute of 2016, the benefits of inclusion, and it does say exactly that.
It does that.
Yeah. Just on that point, and referring back to Richard's reference to the Reasonable Adjustments Project, which he ran whilst I was running the Accessibility Planning Project, and we brought them together in what was known as the Big White Box, because that was how the civil servants decided it should have been a little sort of library of little leaflets, but they would have got into the system much better. But there was a wonderful clip in Richard's filming. A sixth former who had, with training, had helped to set up what was called the Lunch Club.
Yeah.
It was particularly for kids who couldn't cope with the noise and activity at lunchtimes, break times, etc., and needed a quiet place. They could come in, they could, with the sixth form trainees, trained to manage these, so understanding what this was about, they could go in there, they could the clip is actually a couple of kids playing Connect Four. They're not talking to each other at all, but the kids talked about the protective value of a senior pupil passing them in the corridor and say, "Oh, hi Ben, how are you doing? Ooh, big sixth former taking note of me." But the young woman who spoke directly to the camera, Richard had asked her directly, "What's in it for you?" Mindful of the fact he is a sixth former who's studying for exams, whose parents will be anxious, she's being distracted from her studies, etc. Straight to camera, she says, "I think I've become a better rounded person." Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my goodness, if I was an employer in that local area, yes, I'd snap her up, never mind the maths and English. If I've got someone who's got an understanding of those human relationships and how to work with other people, she's the one I would want working with me. So, we need to conclude. And apologies, anyone who had further questions, do please come and talk to everyone, the speakers, to each other as we go. Sue's going to round off with a comment in a moment. I just want to say a few things about the day very quickly. Sue, you started us off with a wonderful insight into how language can imprison our thinking. And Robin, with his, I call it poetry and passion, his wonderful concept of multipliers. That was the people in local authorities who could actually make a difference in terms of local practice. So, comment one, can we all go out, informed by Sue's thinking and Robin's poetry, can we all go out and be multipliers? And I'm speaking particularly to those who are, how do I put this, still of normal working age. the younger generation. Can we inspire the younger generation to go and be multipliers locally? We've talked about the policy and the practice, and particularly from Linda and Richard, the policy. And there is nothing that isn't political, that we've said nothing today that isn't political, deeply, deeply political. To Mark and Artemy, with your ability to act between that political landscape and the practical classroom and school landscape, we thank you for everything that you've been doing through the work of CSIE. Now, there are a couple of things I want to say. One is really about the current opportunity. Richard mentioned the curriculum and assessment review. There are other things that are happening as well. We have Bridget Phillipson committing to a root and branch review. My goodness, we've had so many of those, and it has led to further legislation which has not changed the things that need to change alongside that legislation. But can we, through the curriculum and assessment review, through the review of the Select Committee, which is very much focused on solutions, this is not another analysis of what's going wrong, to be told we're all going to hell in a handcart. This is an analysis of what could work. That they are seeking views up until the end of January. We've got promised changes to teacher training coming in with the combination of the initial teacher training framework and the early career framework for teachers. We've got Martin Oliver last week saying to the Education Select Committee that he wants to change the Ofsted inspection criteria, and in there, if there is something like a report card, something on inclusion will be in there. What is any of this going to look like? Can we take on that agenda and seek to influence that agenda to make sure it's an influence for the good, so that the idea about what inclusion looks like on a report card is informed by what we know about how inclusion works? Just two final anecdotes from me. One, it's related to the assessment aspects of the current system. And if we assess something, people start to value it. So I want to mention a school I visited in Budapest, where in one of the lessons, there was normal content, normal group work, everything as you'd expect. This was a French lesson. Interesting, being in Hungary and having a hearing French lesson. How am I going to understand the French? I couldn't understand the Hungarian at all, but hey-ho. In that lesson, those children were being measured on the quality of their group work. How did they interact? How did they enable everyone in that group to have their say, including children who communicated differently? How was everyone involved? And they themselves had to report as a group on how well they thought they had done on that aspect of the work. I thought that was really interesting because there was a focus on the assessment. That was what the children were focused on. Yes, they learnt the French. That was pretty handy. They weren't to learn that as well. But the focus was on the how well they worked as a group. The other thing I just wanted to mention, the other bit of research, is about high-quality inclusive teaching. Now, this is a meta-analysis of research which is largely American, but I don't see any reason that it isn't applicable to the UK as well. There are about 10 or 12 different factors that the researchers have identified from the other research being carried out. Up near the top were two things that jumped off the page at me. Two things. One, the teachers in those classrooms had a breadth, depth, and detail of understanding of the curriculum that they were working with, that they knew where every single child in that classroom was within that curriculum. If as a teacher you know where that child is, you almost certainly know what the next step is. So you know how to help them to learn and progress. Now, not just that, alongside that, there was the need for that teacher to engage with a pedagogic community and keep their map of the curriculum under constant review. Hold on a minute, I don't understand why this kid could do that, because I thought he had to do this before he could do that, but it turns out he didn't. What does that mean for my... How do I adjust my curriculum map for that? So, I think it comes back to how we think about this. Is it children with learning difficulties, or is it teachers struggling to understand how to adjust the teaching and learning, the way they organise it in their classrooms, to enable every kid to learn? So, thank you. A really inspiring day. Thank you to you all for coming. Really, really grateful to you. Sue, come up here because you just got something more to say, I know.
Well, but several things, basically, but I'm going to be very quick. One, with the GDPR, one of the things I suddenly thought, we have such richness of experience and knowledge in this room. What I'm suggesting, it's more work for our team, so she might be very pissed off with me, but it seems to me that you guys need to talk to each other. So what I'm thinking is, unless you are saying, no way, I don't want to hear from anybody else, we will enable you to all know each other. Is that possible, Artemy, or is that driving you dotty?
We'll think about it.
It seems to me that one of the things that we need to do is keep talking to each other. Okay, that's number one. Number two, masses of attempt and work has been gone in to make sure you've seen everything. So if you've got a chance before you go and get your buses and trains, have a bloody look at what's around, because it's amazing stuff. Three, Richard Reiser and myself and other people in this country have enabled something very magical to occur. We have months where we can focus on different groups. So we have February, LGBT History Month, March, Women's Month, June, Romani and Gypsy, Southeast Asian, Trans, November and December, Disability, October, Black. It is unique. Not every European country has this. Use it, and use it in a way which enables us all to think about all of us. It's a gift which is so rare. And very excitingly, I've been part of a group which we now have 21 LGBT History Months across Europe. Truly exciting. Wow. Also, we started off telling you this was a freebie. You've all known it's a freebie. We have a box outside. I want to see that box full. And I also want to make sure that you know how to take the equality for make it happen out into the world, which means probably you need to buy one yourself and then make sure that other people have it. It is gold dust. I can't say how proud I am of this piece of work. It is so unique to actually enable people to think across the strands. though the characteristics, the strands. So please, talk amongst yourselves, see the information, but most of all, make sure you have access to Equality to Make It Happen, and make sure you get it out into the world, because it is gold dust. And thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, everyone.
In the quarters, I better ask what the local people are saying.
Okay, so I'm going to have to go.
Okay, thank you very much for coming. I wish I could offer you a lift.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
I mean, it's inspiring. I mean, it's 60 years, and lots of work to do.
Yeah.
What about grabbing the opportunity, a new manifesto to reorganize, to grab hold of the inclusion bedrock that is there?
Lovely. Thank you very much. Lovely.
Thanks, Bram. Thank you. Thank you. I have wondered about getting a CSI input.
Can you get a round table?
I don't know. I'll have a go. I'm still doing work for the CDC, but it's which is trying to give greater profile to the Equality Act. My nirvana would be no more SEN framework, just the Equality Act. Because the problem with the SEN framework is so procedural. Every time we legislate, we tighten up the procedures and we make it more and more procedural. So we don't look at the education. People put in for X amount of time with a one-to-one support.
I think what so many people seem to be saying today is the inspiration, the hearts and minds needs to be re-candled, relit.
The problem is the current agenda is, I know it's the last government that started to say inclusion, it's entirely green paper, three problems, poor outcomes, angry parents, high costs. They only try to address the high costs in the improving the new government came in and said, yes, inclusion.
I'm happy to come along here today, but the essence of it, I fear,
still rests in that economically driven argument for inclusion. And that's why I think it's important that we think about a principled approach to inclusion. I don't know that we will persuade the current government to take any notice of I don't know that any recognition of especially any of the other things that you know that people have signed up to and contributed to. But I do think that we might be able to just get some
Thank you so much.
I have one question. I am a researcher from Japan.
I've met lots of people from Japan.
Where do you meet? I mean, you know, some of the research come to see the...
Oh, National Development Team for Inclusion. NDTI, National Development, if you Google it.
Okay. When is that? Is it quite a long time ago? Or when did they come?
There's someone called Nariko... Who is still? She wrote a big thing about Newman.
Yes.
She came and visited.
I see.
And she's coming again this year. And then there was another group a few years ago.
So
we have people from all over the world.
Okay, right. I have one question about what you said. It's very interesting. You said some of them felt children with disability in the working class.
Yes, sir.
Some of them is not happy about their education.
Not people in the system.
people who don't like inclusion
I see.
Who come in and say, what is the point?
Right, so it's sort of normal, I mean, the people in general or the government?
So,
or?
There are certain people in the system, all over the system, who don't like inclusion.
So is it expertise or a specialist or
It's people who don't think these people should be... I mean, there is still a movement that would say these people, we shouldn't have these people in society.
Mm.
There's a woman called Claire Fox who's on all sorts of discussion who thinks if we could find a way of screening out autism, we wouldn't have anyone left in society, would we? I've got to get a train at 4:30.
Good, okay, bye-bye.
I'll invite you to the...
That says Elmo.
Yes, I think there are other members of my family.